come now to the seventh lecture of the course, The Christian View of Savings and Investment. To summarize what we're trying to do, we are dealing with economics as a response to God's economic law word, either obedient response or disobedient, and unfortunately, for the last 200 years, man's economic response to God's law word for his economic life has been very much disobedient, and we see the working out then of God's sovereign judgment upon man's disobedience. And the economic sphere, as far as money is concerned, works out in various kinds of inflation. Here you have what we call demand pull, too much money chasing too few goods, cost push, business firms increasing their prices beyond what they ought to be, same with wages, overinvestment, that means putting up factories and plants, you haven't saved the requisite amount of money beforehand, and government deficit financing. And we try to establish that all these other kinds of inflation arise basically out of two deeper sources. One, overexpansion of bank credit, and the government creation of money through the selling of securities and bonds on the open market. Now we come today to the importance of savings and capitalization. Long-run economic progress and rising standards of living depend on the ability of an economy to increase its per capita output of goods and services without corresponding increases in work hours. Such an increase in output can come with the existing capital stock as a result of improved technology. However, a more likely source of economic progress arises from more or better capital equipment per worker. Capital formation, in turn, depends upon saving and investment. Savings divert part of current gross national product from consumption, while investment uses these productive facilities to create capital goods that will increase future productive capacity. Economic growth and a rising standard of living thus requires both saving and investment. Saving without investment will not add to the productive capacity of the economy. Indeed, it may well generate depression, since not all goods produced are taken off the market. Investment, underlined, without saving, creates inflation. And, in all likelihood, investment secured in this manner cannot be sustained. Now, you see, what we're really getting at here is another aspect of our Christian stewardship. If you like, the money aspect of our stewardship. The term capitalization has been coined to refer to the combined process of savings put into capital investment. R.J. Rushdoony has clarified the meaning of capitalization in the Institutes of Biblical Law as follows. Quote, capitalization is the accumulation of wealth, the conversion of work, savings, and forethought into tangible working assets. No progress is possible without some measure of capitalization. It is a serious error to assume that socialism and communism are opposed to capitalization or to capitalism. Their opposition is simply to private capitalism, but their dedicated policy is to state capitalism. For the state to plan any program of progress, public works or conquest, work, frugality, and forethought are necessary. The work is exacted from the people by force. The frugality is again forced out of the people by means of wage controls, compulsory savings, and bond buying programs, and slave labor. The forethought is provided by the state planners. State capitalism, says Rushdoony, is seriously defective for a number of reasons. Most notably, first of all, it represents theft The private capital of the people is expropriated as well as their work and savings. It is thus a radically dishonest capitalization. Second, forethought is divorced from work and frugality. That is, the planners are not the ones who provide the work and the sacrifice. As a result, the planners have no break of immediate consequences imposed upon them. They can be prodigal in their waste of manpower and capital without bankruptcy, in that the state compels the continuance of their non-economic and wasteful planning. The consequence is that wherever planning is separated from work and savings, instead of capitalization, the result is decapitalization. Socialism is thus by nature imperialistic, in that it must periodically seize or annex a fresh territory in order to have fresh capital to gut by expropriation. Private capital, says Rastuni, is acquired basically in three ways, excluding theft as an illegal and immoral means. These three ways are by work, inheritance, and gift. Private capital must then be utilized by planning, and the loss is the planner's loss, so that there is an incentive to efficiency in private capital, which is lacking in state capitalism. Lawful wealth is that wealth which comes to a man as he abides by God's law and applies work, thrift, and forethought to his activities. Lawful wealth is a covenant promise. Hence the warning by Moses in Deuteronomy 8:11-20, culminating in verse 18 with the statement, "But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he sware unto thy fathers." Capitalization in a society, says Rastuni, requires a background of faith and character. In every era of history, capitalization is a product of the Puritan disposition, of the willingness to forego present pleasures to accumulate some wealth for future purposes. Where there is no character, there is no capitalization, but rather decapitalization, the steady depletion of wealth. Society becomes consumption-centered rather than productive, and it begins to decapitalize the centuries rich inheritance which surrounds it. Thus, decapitalization is preceded always by a breakdown of faith and character. Where men feel that private happiness is man's purpose and goal, rather than serving and glorifying God and finding joy in him, where men feel that life owes them something rather than seeing themselves as debtors to God, and where men feel called to fulfill themselves apart from God rather than in him, their society is in rapid process of decapitalization. The purpose of wealth is the establishment of God's covenant. Its goal is that man prosper in his task of possessing the earth. The means to lawful wealth is the covenant law, the law of God. Capitalization is thus a radical and total task. End of quotation from Rastuni. Now let us deal with the Calvinistic origins of this capitalization. In his famous work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, the German economist and sociologist, should be Max Weber, proved that Calvinism is the source of capitalization in the sense described so well by Rastuni. It was not the godless variety of capitalism we know today that Max Weber found in Calvinism, but rather a certain capitalist temper or frame of mind in which hard work, wealth, savings, and profit could become not merely tolerated and enjoyed, but actually made into something ethically compelling. In the following passage, Weber gives us the kernel of the problem that fascinated him. The passage is set in the larger discussion of the paradox of a manifest capitalist spirit, in the institutional and material sense, backward circumstances of 18th century America, and conversely, the lack of such a spirit in affluent bourgeoisie Florence of the Italian Renaissance. He writes, "Now how could activity, which was at best ethically tolerated, that is in Italy, turn into a calling in the sense of Benjamin Franklin. The fact to be explained historically is that in the most highly capitalistic centre of the time, in Florence, of the 14th and 15th centuries, the money and capital market of all the great powers, this attitude was considered ethically unjustifiable, or at best, only to be tolerated. But in the backwoods, small bourgeois circumstances of Pennsylvania in the 18th century, where business threatened for simple lack of money to fall back into barter, where there was hardly a sign of large enterprise, where only the earliest beginnings of banking were to be found, the same thing was considered the essence of moral conduct, even commanded in the name of duty. What was the background of ideas which could account for the sort of activity apparently directed toward profit alone as a calling to which the individual feels himself to have an ethical obligation? It was this idea which gave the way of the business entrepreneur its ethical foundation and justification. End of quotation. Reduced to its essentials, this idea was, of course, the Calvinist idea of the calling. The doctrine that in his undeviating pursuit of wealth, or rather the saving of wealth or capital, in his devotion to the precepts of personal frugality, in his hard work, in all these, as well as in his worship of God on the Lord's Day, the individual Christian is serving and glorifying his God, and fulfilling a vocation not any the less sacred or religious because of its orientation toward the mundane, the economic, and the secular. The Calvinist doctrine of the calling led a man like John Calvin to seek to build a republic in Geneva true to the law of God. It led countless Calvinist businessmen in England, Holland, Scotland, and America to prove the fact of their election in the success of their business ventures. Such Calvinists did not waste either their time or their hard-earned money in riotous living. Instead, they worked and they saved. In this way, claimed Weber, Calvinist worldly asceticism imposed the high standards and organized life of the medieval monk upon all Christians, laity as well as clergy. All men and women, not just monks and nuns, must serve God faithfully in the occupation to which God has called them. And you may remember the medieval monks had that beautiful motto, "To work is to pray." Sinful though man may be, he must still glorify God in his daily work, however mundane it might be. Thus, maximum effort and attention must be devoted to ensuring a life of continuous service. Hard work and the rational organization of time and resources thus became essential virtues. Furthermore, worldly possessions and luxuries were a source of pride and temptation, so time and money must not be wasted upon them. Thrift was the golden rule. Every Christian is called upon to work hard and to save, and not spend his earnings and wages. The application of this Protestant ethic, as Weber called it, to men's daily lives were tremendous. It released dynamic forces which changed the history of the world. It was men imbued with the spirit who opened up the East and West Indies to European trade, dammed the dikes of Holland, cleared the bushland of America and Canada. Consumption was limited, production was encouraged. Surplus capital, which couldn't be spent on vain luxuries, was re-injected into Anglo-American and Dutch business enterprises, thus providing a plentiful flow of capital and hence lubricating the economic and monetary advance of the great capitalist nations. Calvinism, that is to say, helped in the great process of the capitalization and modernization of America, Britain, Canada, and Holland. In the Middle Ages, trade and money-making had been regarded as morally dangerous, and profit-making even antisocial. The unforeseen consequence of the Calvinist ethic was to make money-making not just socially acceptable, but together with hard work, a moral obligation. The Christian has been called by his God to be a capitalist, in the sense of careful stewardship of the resources given to him by his God, and of applying the fruits and savings of his labor to investment in capital goods. As well as removing the psychological obstacles to the expansion of commerce, trade, and industry, the Calvinist ethic also directly encouraged ways of life which greatly assisted economic advance by limiting consumption and increasing production. In effect, early Christian capitalism, responsible to God, was an expression of the biblical mandate given to man at his creation to have dominion over the earth and subdue it. As Rossini well says, man must seek to subdue the earth and gain wealth as a means of restitution and restoration, as a means of establishing God's dominion in every realm. Wherever godly men establish their superior productivity and gain wealth, they thereby glorify God. Wealth in itself is good and a blessing of the Lord. It is trust in wealth rather than in God which Scripture condemns. Godly wealth is basic to God's purposes for the earth. It is a vital link in the task of restoration. End of quotation. Such a responsible capitalism is therefore the outward expression of the inner Calvinist and Reformed spirit. To work hard and rationally with a view to profit and not to spend the profit is, of course, par excellence, the conduct necessary to the development of capitalism, since capitalism is best defined precisely as the pursuit of profit which is not consumed but reinvested. Hence, no Calvinist need be ashamed of being a capitalist in this biblical sense of that much abused word. That is how Max Weber also defined it, as the rational organization of work with a view to greater production and profit, so that the profit thus made is not consumed but saved in order that more productive capital may be built up. Even Karl Marx had to admit this when he sneered in Das Kapital, "Accumulate, accumulate, this is the law and the profit." As it happens, the Calvinist ethic provided an ethical and religious motivation for this strange behavior, of which there had been no previous example in history, of the pursuit of the highest possible profit, not in order to enjoy life's pleasures, but simply for the satisfaction of pleasing God by one's hard work and of producing more and more and saving the profit. Had our Anglo-American Calvinist forebears not had this high sense of their calling to serve the Lord by a godly self-discipline at work and at play, as well as the habit of thrift and saving, it is doubtful whether our modern industrial society would ever have been built, depending as it does upon the need for men's resourcefulness and enterprise, persistence, precision, judgment, and reliability in dealing with machines, and above all upon the accumulation and formation of capital. Had our reform forebears not had a future orientation, you and I might still be living in mud huts, as do the starving millions of Africa and Asia. The United States was settled by men who, however humble their origins, were upper class men by virtue of their vision of the future. They left their old homeland in terms of a future oriented vision. They came to America in search of God, unlike the Spaniards who went to South America in search of gold. The Reformed faith, which believes in God's sovereignty and coming kingdom, is bound to be future-oriented. That is why the lands of the Reformation have seen more progress in science, democracy, and constitutional law, and government, and liberty, than any other lands, since these have been the blessings the Lord has bestowed upon those who first sought his glory. It is thus no accident the scientific, and then the Industrial Revolution, took place first in England, Holland, Germany, and the United States, the main centers of evangelical and reformed Christianity. For the workers and businessmen of these lands had, thanks to their evangelical and reformed upbringing in the Holy Scriptures, learned first how to do an honest day's work and then to save their earnings. No other religion in the world has been capable of creating a similar progress in all fields of human life, because none other has had the future orientation of biblical faith. The future-oriented people capitalize a civilization. They work and save in terms of a goal. They forego present pleasures for future gain. They save their money rather than spend it in riotous living. Their entire life and activity is geared to capitalization and investment. With the breakdown of Calvinism in America today, it is not therefore surprising to see the opposite tendencies at work in our society. Many secular humanists may best be described as existentialists in their orientation. They subscribe to a view of life in which the present moment is decisive, and hence they may be described as lower class in their psychological orientation, as Edward Banfield puts it in The Unheavenly City, where one's class is defined in terms of one's orientation, either toward the future, making you upper class, or towards the present, making you lower class. The existentialist has no concern for the future, so he uses up all his resources now. To him, the idea of saving for a future is stupid, since, as Lord Keynes fatuously once said, in the long run, we're all dead. Of the evil economic consequences of such an attitude, William Roker has warned us in A Humane Economy, in which he discusses this connection with inflation. Now, I'm going to briefly summarize the long quotation on page 4 from William Roker. He simply says that it's no good of having investments without prior saving. If you try to start building factories and buying capital goods by going to the bank for a bank loan, and there hasn't been the corresponding saving to back it up, this, of course, itself helps to bring about more inflation. But remember, it's not the investment as such which is responsible, but the overexpansion of the bank credit. Please turn to page 5. And here we discuss the effects of inflation upon savings, and I hope this puts the fear of God into you all, makes you realize what's going on. The funds belonging to America's savers are held in 9 principal forms of investment. First, one of the largest single investments is in life insurance and annuities. The actual sum that's accumulated at any time is not the face amount of outstanding life insurance and annuity policies, but the reserves held by the insurance companies for such policies. A second important investment made for individuals is the total of trust funds held by the government for old age pensions, employment, and disability insurance, railroad retirement funds, veterans' life insurance. A third source is the total of savings or time deposits in the nation's commercial and mutual savings banks. In recent years, the percentage of depreciation of each dollar in deposit has exceeded the interest earned during the year. The stated amount of deposit has increased as interest was added, but even the deposit thus enlarged will buy less than it would have at the beginning of the year. The fourth principal investment, likewise vulnerable to inflation, is the total of accounts with saving and loan associations and credit unions. A fifth principal investment is in the form of U.S. government bonds. About 4/5 of the total held by individuals are U.S. savings bonds, so widely owned. For all government bonds, Dr. Franz Pick, the world expert on depreciating currencies, has coined the appropriate name, Certificates of Guaranteed Confiscation. Once upon a time, that name could not justly have been applied to the securities issued by the United States government. But that was in the days when a gold clause guaranteeing repayment at maturity in dollars of the same gold weight and fineness as that when the bonds were issued, comma, was honored. A sixth investment made by savers is in bonds of states and municipalities. A seventh is in the bonds of corporations. An eighth investment is in loans secured by mortgages. And ninth form of investment includes the currency as well as checking accounts held by many individuals known as idle balances. And here we have a concrete measure of the nation's inflation. Now you look at that table while I give the explanation. In the above table we show the annual amount saved in the form of the nine principal types of investments held by 40 million of the nation's families. The remaining 12 million families and a few million individuals, including the politicians who have indirectly used these funds to buy votes, the speculators, and the workers and labor unions, probably all gained from the effects of the prolonged inflating. You can see the total amount of these savings. Column 2 of the table shows the total of such investments at the end of 1939 and the accumulation each year thereafter for specified years in these then current dollars. As nearly everyone by now knows, the dollars invested during previous years now purchase less. Savers have suffered a tremendous loss of real wealth because of inflation and the resultant increase in prices. In order to calculate this loss, we have expressed the savings during each previous year in terms of the depreciated dollars and have shown the result in column 4. That's the savings expressed in depreciated dollars. Now this was done by multiplying the column 2 entry by the most recently available consumer price index and dividing by the index at the middle of the year involved. Note, of the savings during 1940 are 39.1 billion expressed in depreciated dollars, savers could only claim 11.9 billion. The difference of 27.2 billion shown in column 5 is the loss of savings accumulated during that year which resulted from inflation. Now, the next paragraph I think ought to shock you all. By the end of 1973, such losses by savers in this country amounted to over $1 trillion. Now that's a figure which is just incomprehensible, so we're going to put it another way. If the nation's forgotten men, that's the middle classes, comprise the 40 million families who do the saving, this loss works out at $27,000 per family. The losses to savers and holders of life insurance during the past 34 years in relation to total wealth has been 65 times the relative loss suffered by depositors whose banks failed during the Great Slump, 29-33. About 1.3 billion in the then current dollars. The total of $27,000 per family for the last 34 years is $794 per year. For the average family of four, this roughly is equal to the cost of their car every year, or it is one third of their food, or more than half their clothing budget every year. No wonder President Nixon has said inflation robs and cheat Americans. Now I want to break down the origin of savings and investment, first of all dealing in terms of the sources and the uses and the transfers. Since the act of saving is simply the non-expenditure of income received during a given period, saving may originate in any one of the millions of American households, businesses, or governmental units that receive income. Investment, in the sense of capital formation, is based on decisions to build or assemble new houses, new plants, new equipment, inventories, new schools and roads. Investment may also originate in any one of the millions of American households, businesses, or governmental units in the nation. It follows, therefore, society requires an efficient system by which funds, which are claimed to resources, can be transferred conveniently and quickly from their points of origin in savings to their points of use in investment. This transfer is brought about by the capital market, which comprises all those institutions and devices necessary to achieve the smooth transition of saving into investment. You can add there it is thus an essential part of our Christian stewardship in the modern world. Now, the source of the private saving. Private saving occurs in two main ways. One, corporations set aside a part of their gross income as depreciation and other capital consumption allowances. In addition, they pay only a part of their net profit after income tax as dividends. The remainder is retained. Both depreciation allowances and retained earnings are gross savings, and these funds are available for investment. Secondly, individual and unincorporated businesses consume less than their current disposable income. In 1971, gross private investment was $151 billion, it should be. And number six is the reference at the back of the paper. Uses. The principal use of that portion of the national income that is saved, that is not consumed, is to increase society's stock of capital goods. In other words, it finances gross private domestic investment, for example, new plants, new equipment, new houses, etc. In addition to private domestic investment, saving may be used, one, to acquire claims against the government by buying bonds, two, to acquire claims against foreigners by foreign investment. The function of the capital market is to transfer these savings to those who use them for purposes of capital formation or, to a lesser extent, for consumption. If this transfer does not take place, the savings remain as idle balances. Below, we show a diagram of the capital market of an advanced industrial society such as the United States. Here on the left, you have the savers, the saving intermediaries, and the markets, which constitute the capital market. On the right, the users, working through the borrowing intermediaries. The flow of saving from saver to ultimate user may take one of a number of routes. The figure above shows the variety of net flows possible in the modern capital market. These typical net flows among the five broad sectors are a result of larger gross flows along the path indicated, which are offset in part by gross flows running in the opposite direction. In addition, there are flows within each of the sectors. Commercial banks participate in the capital market in two ways. In one way, they perform much the same function as the other saving intermediaries. This is especially true with respect to their savings department. But as holders of demand deposit accounts and the largest source of short-term loans in the economy, they play a unique role in almost every aspect of capital market activity. The ability and willingness of banks to lend and invest impinges on all institutions in all sectors of the saving investment process. Now, the sources of savings. Funds flowing to the capital market come mainly from the saving of the private sectors of the economy, domestic, non-financial businesses, consumers, state and local governments. As shown in the table below, the investment of funds in capital markets by these private sectors averaged about $3 billion, it should be, put in dollar mark, in 1961-65, compared with an average of only $300 million for the federal government and about $700 million for foreign investors. The average flow to capital markets of $29 billion in 61-65 compares with the total of $20.7 billion invested by the private sectors and non-capital market instruments such as money, short-term U.S. government securities, and consumer loans. The end of 65, the private sector's direct holdings of long-term debt instruments was $117.6 billion by households and $49.3 billion by state and local governments. Alone were larger than the total stock of money, demand deposits, and currency held by these sectors. Also, their holdings of claims on financial intermediaries, such as insurance and pension reserves, were three times as large as the privately held money supply. Consumer savings reached capital markets primarily through financial intermediaries. The margin by which Intermediated flows that see the direct investment has widened in recent years. In the period 51 to 60, the margin was roughly 6 to 1, while in the 61 to 69 period, intermediated flows exceeded direct purchases of capital instruments by almost 40 to 1. Then I go on to deal with the structure of the capital markets. Capital markets may be viewed as the mechanism through which savings are made available to those who seek long-term financing. Capital markets in the United States utilize a private market mechanism with participants free to take advantage of differentials in price, terms, and convenience. Government lending and borrowing usually account for only a small percentage of the transactions that take place in these capital markets. Now, we have to qualify that now. You turn to this handout you were given, earnings on savings. One of the problems we are up against now is that the... well, just look at the third paragraph. It says, more and more money is being drawn out of the stock market and less is being invested by individuals in stocks, mutual funds. The reason goes far beyond the disillusionment of millions of investors with the potential for profits in stocks. The bloodbath so many have taken in the stock market, the harm done by the go-go performance-mad institutional investment managers. It goes to the core of the matter, what you can earn. And today you can easily earn twice as much in highest grade bonds as you can in stocks. So, if you like, the federal government is offering a higher rate of interest on its bonds and thereby attracting badly needed capital and savings away from the private sector, where it would be used to build up our economy, and is simply using this money for deficit financing, which I think is absolutely disgraceful. Now, capital market instruments, turn over on page 8. I think you can read all these figures for yourself. These different types of capital market instruments. That means the various kinds of various forms into which you can put your savings. Then you have at the bottom of page 8 the main saving intermediaries, mutual savings societies, savings and loans, life insurance, private pension funds. I might add that those are increasing. And you can imagine what the inflation of the money supply is going to do to our precious private pension scheme, not to mention our Social Security payments. The state and local governments, retirement funds, investment companies, funds advanced in other credit markets. Turn over to page 9, please. The savings intermediaries, and underline this sentence, these are specialized institutions including savings banks, savings and loan associations, life insurance companies, and so on. The financial institutions with which the saver may place his funds perform a service that may be described as security substitution. They make available to savers their own securities, which are acceptable to the savers and suitable for their needs, and they place their own securities with saver desire for other securities that lack appeal to these savers. The corollary is the institutions manage the portfolios of securities they hold, shifting them about as their judgment dictates. Investing institutions such as savings banks and investment companies are formed to invest other people's funds, while institutional investors such as insurance companies and pension funds are formed primarily for purposes other than investments, but in the course of their activities acquire substantial funds which they put to work to stay in business. And then you have the borrowing intermediaries. These are specialized institutions that assist potential borrowers who desire to engage in capital formation to tap the various sources in which savings originate or accumulate. Investment banking houses act as intermediaries for corporate borrowers. Mortgage banking houses serve as an intermediary function for home builders. Sales finance companies and personal finance companies channel funds into consumer credit and commercial paper dealers assist in directing funds into commercial credit. Unless the saver, on the basis of personal contact, directly makes funds available to others for capital formation, engages in real investment himself, or places his saving with a financial institution as intermediary, he must make use of a marketing institution in order to acquire the securities issued by the enterprises that engage in capital formation. Then I go on to describe the various kinds of borrowing intermediaries. And lastly, you have the savings intermediaries. The development of saving intermediaries provided an efficient system of marshalling the savings of millions of individuals and of translating these accumulated funds into investments under full-time professional supervision. Both saving on the one hand and capital formation on the other are encouraged because such intermediaries exist. The pooling of funds improves the allocation of society's productive resources to the projects with greater economic merit, and hence they help us act as better stewards of the resources God has given to us. In addition, the growth of financial intermediaries has certain other consequences that are of significance to the process of monetary control over consumption, savings, and investment. One of the most important of these effects relates to the liquidity that financial intermediaries provide. Now, by liquidity, it simply means being able to turn an investment quickly and readily into cash. And as you know, you can always turn an ordinary deposit in the bank into cash by writing out a check. But if you want to get money out of your time deposit, you've got to give the bank a few days' notice. An important feature of savings held by financial intermediaries is their liquidity. Time and savings deposits, savings and loan shares, savings bonds and life insurance policy reserves are not as liquid as demand deposits. In practice, however, these assets possess many of the features of money in cash in the bank. This is especially true if one views these assets from the point of view of the individual who holds them. They have a fixed dollar demand, just as money has, and they can in practice be withdrawn on demand. The only difference is these assets can't be transferred directly. Another important aspect of the liquidity effect of non-bank financial intermediaries is their impact on the stabilization policies pursued by the central bank. Since these institutions issue liability, they are like money, and they are beyond the direct control of the central bank. And so they have the potential to enable the community to expand its capacity to finance expenditures with a given stock of money. And I think this is very important. Underlined in this manner, non-bank financial intermediaries may weaken the control of the central bank over the level of expenditure. In addition, some of these financial intermediaries as a whole are organized into broader groups such as the Federal Home Loan Bank System. And I go and talk about the insurance of claims and assets. Don't think just because your money in the bank is insured by this stupid government scheme that it means anything. According to that quote from Elgin Grossclothes, the government simply sort of promises to pay you back in an inflated currency. Now, lastly, I want to deal with the church's relation to investment, that is, the church as an institution. This is something which very few Christians have even bothered to think about. Perhaps the most vital economic issues facing the church as institution today are two. Should the church as such invest its money and savings in secular enterprises? Two, should the churches of America pay taxes on their incomes, receive from profits on their investments, and on businesses they run and the property they own? American churches of all traditions have grown phenomenally wealthy since 1900. collections, free will offerings, legacies, investment income have all grown in America's growingly affluent society. As a result, there are now billions of church dollars tucked away in real estate and investments, thus inviting the communist jibe, the church has become the kept woman of apostate capitalism. It is said the total church wealth of the United States in real estate alone is over $80 billion. And that if the $700 million worth of church-owned property in New York City alone paid taxes, it would bring in another $35 million a year to the city. No wonder that the state, both federal, state, and local, is now taking a good long look at the synonymous, and that churchmen are sensitive to the issues involved. Apart from this enormous wealth in real estate, the American churches also control between them at least 10% of America's total share capital. In England, the church commissioners hold over $1 billion worth of shares. These taxless millions, which flow into the church's coffers from property and investment, are made to appear worse in the eyes of the world by the trading activities of some churches, which through their national organizations are involved in business operations ranging from ranching, farms, hotels, bakeries, and lumber mills to sausage factories and garbage disposal plants. Much to the shock of the church commissioners of the Church of England, it was discovered that the Church of England was gaining profits from houses which it owned in Glasgow, and that unknown to the church commissioners, the people who were renting the houses from the church commissioners were in turn renting them out as brothels. And there was the Church of England making a pile of money out of prostitution. Completely unknown, of course, to the church commissioners. And when it was found out, people were kicked out. Now, some of the Roman Catholic orders are keen promoters of fine foods and cheeses, and the Christian Brothers, of course, of their beautiful wine. And the activities of Seventh-day Adventists and the Mormons help to put the modern church's trading ventures into the realm of big business. These tax-free businesses are giving the church a bad name in the eyes of many American and British secular humanists who see not only tax-free competitors but a hidden state recognition of religion. In other words, the state appears to be subsidizing the church by allowing it to escape the tax man. It should also be a cause of grave concern to the Christian conscience. Such large-scale investments raise grave questions when we remember the Son of Man has not where to lay his head. Can the Bride of Christ hold shares in breweries, armament concerns, and the cosmetic industry, not to mention Hollywood? Is the right use of the church's money simply to obtain the biggest possible financial return for the church, or is it to meet human needs? Once Christians accept the idea, the only important thing is to obtain the biggest return for their church's investments, because the church is a good thing, then they will be on the road that leads to the belief that anything done in the name of the church must be right, and that the good end which the church seeks to serve can justify whatever bad means it may have to adopt to make ends meet. An apologist for the church commissioners of the Church of England spoke to Paul Faris about this problem as follows. He said, the Christian is living in two worlds. He can't escape. He must come to terms with the fact this is a fallen world. It is by the motives of self-interest that God's people are preserved. While as citizens we may try to soften the effect of economic forces and hedge the motive of self-interest with restraint, basically we're all in competition. The whole economic system of the world is basically sinful, and we must be in a constant state of penitence. We are concerned with the redemption of the world. But as custodians of funds given by Christian people for Christian objects, we must preserve those funds so they're adequate for the purposes they were given. One would obviously avoid investment in something flagrantly immoral, but most business is pretty well conducted they're all pretty decent to their staff. So one is looking primarily for the best investment. And believe you me, these guys are pretty smart. They increased the value of the Church of England's investments after the war. They began to transfer them into the progressive industries, and I think they trebled the investment value of the Church of England's sort of total savings over the years. Now, while agreeing there is a sound case for accepting the stock market as part of God's plan for the unfolding process of financial history, I would point out that Christians are under obligation to Christ to make moral choices that are in accordance with His will and His purpose for His church. In other words, even if we invest the church's money, we still have the responsibility as Christ's stewards of investing it where it will bring most glory to God and most benefit to human need, not just where there is a profit to be made. There are investments such as low-cost housing schemes, and hospital and school bonds, where the church's savings can be put to good and Christian use. In answer to the question, should the church as an institution invest its savings in secular business enterprises, which I put to Dr. Herman Dooyeboord of the Free University in Amsterdam by a private letter, I received the following reply, says Dooyeboord. In my opinion, it would be contrary to the inner nature of the church to do so in a speculative manner by investing its savings in shares issued by private profit enterprises. But there are many other ways of investing these savings which do not meet any reasonable objection. For example, in municipal bonds or charitable institutions. End of quote. This vulnerable situation in which all Western Christian churches now find themselves involved has led to the formation of an unofficial group of American Episcopalian lawyers and clerics to keep a watchful eye on the position. In an interesting report, they plead for a new morality on church finances. Amongst other recommendations, the report suggests there should be a more public disclosure of investments and property ownership, and by reason of their tax-favored position, the churches should cooperate with the tax authorities in making plain what their financial position really is where taxes are involved. The group does not believe a case has been made out that the tax exemptions accorded to the churches constitute the most important government recognition of religion in America, nor that the present methods infringe the constitutional position of church and state in America. They point to the fact that church exemption from taxes is an American tradition, granted in view of the general benefit which the churches confer on the community. If taxes were levied, it would mean the disappearance of much philanthropic work which would then fall on the community and perhaps the state to maintain. Of this report, Dooyeboord has written the writer as follows. I can completely agree with the argument of the American group of Anglican lawyers and clerics with respect to the tax exemption now accorded to the churches by the United States government. To my mind, this question has nothing to do with the inner sphere sovereignty of the churches, but belongs exclusively to the inner sphere of the state. The church cannot as such claim tax exemption. It can only do so by appealing to the public interest and public legal justice, and on the same footing as charitable institutions. In other words, on terms of equality with the latter. In a very important article published as an appendix to the Institutes of Biblical Law, titled Stewardship, Investment and Usury, Financing the Kingdom of God, Gary North points out, non-profit corporations are supposed to be essentially charitable. They're not allowed to receive all residuals after all costs are met, and for that reason the civil government grants to these corporations the right to escape taxes. The taxable business, however, is allowed to keep profit for the owners. The tax laws recognize the distinction between a return for service and a return on investment. Charity is not a business. And then he goes on to have a tremendous attack on this new idea of various Christian organizations selling annuities. He thinks that's completely immoral. On the question of the church running businesses for profits, even though the profits go to church causes, the American group of Anglican lawyers and clerics is quite firm. These businesses, it thinks, should be taxed in the normal way. And he recommends the churches to see to their affairs as soon as possible. I remember how shocked I was when I was assistant minister of St. Matthew's Church in Hampstead, Montreal, to discover that the Roman Catholic hierarchy in Quebec province operates bakeries in order to remain tax-free. They have on the outside the chapel of St. John the Divine. And you go and you smell the most delicious bread you ever smelt in your life. Rather peculiar. Now we come finally to Christian savings and borrowing institutions. Which of the various savings and borrowing intermediaries can the Christian support with his own savings and borrow from if necessary? On this matter, each individual Christian will have to be guided by his own conscience and by his interpretation of the Word of God. However, it would seem in the opinion of this Christian speaker that Christians ought to form their own savings and borrowing associations, including Christian building societies, credit unions, and so on. Time doesn't allow us to consider all the possible Christian financial institutions which could be established, so let us say something here about credit unions. Credit unions are organized among groups having some ideological interest in common. For example, a church, a labor union, or employees of a company. A credit union accepts the deposits of and makes loans to members of the credit union. The institution is similar to a cooperative in that the rates paid on deposits depend on earnings, and borrowers may receive a refund if actual earnings exceed anticipated earnings. The normal interest rate of 1% per month is considerably less than finance company rates, and the risk on loans made by credit unions is less because borrowers, as members of the union, have a greater incentive to pay off their debts. The administrative expenses of credit unions are also considerably less than they are for finance companies because the credit union staff consists of members who work without pay. To encourage thrift among their employees, some employers subsidize their credit unions to enable them to pay higher returns to their depositors. This also enables members who might otherwise have to borrow from other institutions to borrow at lower rates charged by their credit union. Although loans of smaller amounts are unsecured, those above $400 require collateral. At the end of 66, there were over 22,000 credit unions in the United States, representing about 16 million members. And this is very popular, by the way, amongst Roman Catholics. Outstanding installment credit of the credit unions totaled $8.5 billion at the end of 66. The institutions are either state or federally chartered and are subject to examination by the government authorities. Credit unions have shown a sharp growth in the post-war period, as the table below shows. They've gone up from assets of $4.4 billion in 45 to $9.2 billion in 66, and I think by now it's up in the region of about $15 billion. One of the most exciting recent developments in the credit union movement has been the launching of the Christian Savings and Credit Union founded in Edmonton, Alberta. This is by Reformed Calvinists. Their recent statement of purpose is one of the most significant documents to be published in North America in this vitally important field, and should be read and studied by every Christian economist and banker. The Christian Savings and Credit Union Limited of Alberta is seeking to reform the financial aspect of human life. Part of its statement of purpose declares, "The rule of Christ over all things establishes the kingdom of God, making economic activity possible and meaningful. The mandate of economic enterprise is for the building and coming of his kingdom. Economics is a free and responsible administration of the scarcity of means and resources to the satisfaction of alternative and differing human, personal, and communal needs as seen in the kingdom perspective. Economic freedom demands that the promotion of communal enterprise and action and the establishment of a source of credit is to be undertaken in the God-given freedom of a complete and voluntary submission to the Word of God. End of quote. Were John Calvin and Richard Baxter living today, I am sure they would endorse every word of this splendid statement. I mention Baxter because he, to my knowledge, was the last great Calvinist thinker who specifically dealt with these everyday problems. Should Christians charge usury? And so on. In his great directory of the Christian life. Like Calvin's work, the work of the Alberta Christian Credit Association is founded on the biblical principle that life is religion, not making money. Now please make a correction, full stop. Hence the Christian is to engage in saving and using money for the glory of God and the benefit of human need and the advancement of God's kingdom. And I might say here, on behalf of the speakers at this conference, we certainly heartily appreciate the tremendous sacrifice which Bob Metcalf has made and is making on behalf of the Christian Study Center. I think every Christian in America will one day acknowledge the debt to this great man. May God bless him and give him many more years of service. God in Christ didn't come just to save our so-called spiritual part of life, but the whole of our lives, and that must include the financial. The first report on the Christian doctrine of wealth of the Congregational Churches of Scotland put it very well. They said, "The Christian doctrine of wealth is based on the gospel of the goodwill of God as revealed in Jesus Christ for the whole of human society. It is a grave limitation of the gospel to regard it simply as a declaration of the purpose and power of God to save souls in the narrow sense in which that phrase has been and still is used. The good purpose of God, as revealed in Christ, is to save the whole man, to redeem the whole human situation on earth. We cannot contend for the gospel in its fullness unless we contend for that truth. Material wealth is sacred, for it is invested with the love of God. To waste it, abuse it, restrict it, hoard it, or withhold it is to blaspheme the giver." I thank you.